This episode, I'm joined once again by writer and occultist John Michael Greer to discuss his recently re-editioned book, A World Full of Gods, An Inquiry into Polytheism. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you'd like to support the podcast and keep it running, as it runs off patronage alone, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, John Michael Greer, thanks once again for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me on again.
We are going to be discussing a book called A World Full of Gods, An Inquiry into Polytheism, which was, I believe this is a republished 20
That's correct.
This year by Aeon, who was kind enough to send me a copy, so thanks very much. Mm-hmm. But this was one of your sort of fairly early books, and it was pretty popular back then, I believe, or...?
In a certain, let's see, it certainly found an audience. It was originally released by a very small publisher, one that was run by an American Druid organization, not the one that I headed. And it was released with minimal hoopla, and of course it was ignored by the mainstream, the way small presses always are. Mm. But it very quickly found an audience among polytheists, among people who follow religions that include more than one deity, because there really wasn't anything else at that time available that talked about the internal logic of polytheism, why it makes sense to talk about gods rather than just God. And so I ended up getting a lot of friendly letters, a lot of favorable reviews within that community. And as far as its impact on the wider world, the one thing that I note is that a bunch of academics suddenly popped up and started talking about polytheism for the next few years. So I found that amusing.
Yeah, that's probably what I meant was, because it's something you emphasize early on in the book, that there was a distinct lack of this for quite a while. And that's I can tell by your reaction that's saying something.
It really is saying something. What happened was that I had gotten involved after I'd finished working through the study program in the first Druid organization that I joined, Obot, the Order of Bards, Ovites, and Druids. And I went looking for some other sources of Druid study, ended up affiliated for a while with a particular American organization that was very much into polytheism. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I'm going to go down to the library and see if I can find some books on philosophy of religion that discuss polytheism. No. What there was an endless profusion of books that talked as though the only possible religious options were zero gods or one. Take your pick. This irritated me. It also left me going, seriously? And so I had discussions with other people, other druids and so on. It just kind of unfolded. And one of the central parts of the whole argument, the cat analogy that dominates chapter 6, that actually came into being in an email post to a list of druid polytheists. And it just kind of exploded from there. And before I quite knew what I was doing, I had a book in process. So, yeah, that's kind of the origin myth, if you will, of A World Full of Gods, or as many of my friends called it back in the day, thinking of it as a kind of spaghetti western, A Fistful of Gods. Think of Clint Eastwood as polytheist. The running joke now among my friends is the new edition, of course, it has got to be For a Few Gods More.
That's very good. What's the third one in that trilogy?
Oh, that would be The Good, the Bad, and the Godly, of course.
Ah, there we go.
We're not there yet. We're not there yet.
I mean, I could make a sort of... Well, I could make a joke about Westerns in relation to really what you're talking about in your book of this actually like a historical survivorship bias, because people forget the fact that with Westerns, I think they're making like two a week at some point or something, right? People say, oh, well, I love Westerns.
Oh, yeah.
No, you love the Westerns that we acknowledge now, but there was, and I feel maybe the same way about gods in a way, that once you start delving into it, you know, there's... We're limited to about 10 in the West, sort of thing, in popular culture. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, you're quite right that, you know, our popular culture is aware of the existence of a tiny number of gods. But most of the world's religions worship a great many of them. And developed polytheist religions often have estimates of the total number of gods that are fairly impressive. I think it's Shinto in Japan that their working estimate is that there are 8 million gods. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as far as I know, Hinduism has a much higher estimate, but you'd expect that from the Hindus. It's a bigger continent.
But one thing I want to emphasize is a foundation that you set that it really got me thinking. It got me thinking about biases. It got me thinking about it maybe even sunk costs, but a lot of fallacies that we love in the West because it makes everything a lot easier. Which is when we say the word theism, we pretty much, in fact, yeah, I mean, we're not even really alluding to anything else other than we mean monotheism, and I would say in the West we mean monotheism of primarily Abrahamic religions. Theism is definitely monotheism. Well, like, I'm not saying that this is how it is, but in Western studies of it, historically speaking, theism means monotheism, and most of the time it means Abrahamic monotheism.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, if you look in the philosophical literature, you look into the philosophy of religion and things like that, you will find the term classical theism used, you know, as so many words for essentially not merely Abrahamic, but the Christian conception of God. That's classical theism, and it's the only alternative presented to atheism, which is an incredibly narrow view of world religion.
Where does that begin, do you think, that move towards trying to constrain all belief into monotheism or atheism?
Well, the thing is, that's absolutely standard in most aspects of Western culture. We have this fixation on binaries, and it's very easy for people who have an agenda to use that, insist out of an alphabet of possibilities. The only ones that actually matter are L and M. And if you're not in favor of L, you must be in favor of M. If you're not in favor of M, you must be in favor of L. We have exactly the same situation in the current world between, corporate capitalism and state socialism. Those are the only two economic systems that are acknowledged as possible. And the fact that there's an entire alphabet from A to Z, and beyond that into other alphabets, does not get a word in. It's very much easier for the people, again, who have agendas to push, if they can limit it down to this very narrow notion of what is possible. And you can see that it is, in fact, a very narrow notion in the religious case, especially. Look at your atheists and look at your mainstream Christian monotheists. Ask either one about astrology, say, and they'll both denounce it heatedly. Ask either one of them about polytheism, and they'll both lose their cool completely. And they'll do it in the same way. So what all this points to is the fact that atheism and monotheism are simply small variations on a common theme. What that common theme is, we can get into as we proceed.
So let's perhaps begin from that. We begin just with a definition of monotheism and then a definition of polytheism.
Okay. Fortunately, this is one of the places where the words are actually a pretty good indicator of the meaning. Monotheism is the belief that there's one and only one God. What the philosophers call classical theism, and I call classical monotheism, is the belief that there's one and only one God who is infinite, eternal, omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent, and so on through the usual labels. Okay, that's monotheism. Most people are familiar with it. Polytheism is the belief that there are many gods, not just one. There are at least, shall we say, two, but usually in a developed polytheism, there are many of them. There are scores, hundreds, thousands, in Shinto, a million. They are not generally infinite, eternal, omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent, and all that sort of stuff. They are not considered to be that. They may be benevolent. They may be wise. In fact, they are generally wise, powerful, and benevolent, but not omni-anything. And of course, there are a lot of them. They do not necessarily all agree with each other. There are potential conflicts, or often manifest conflicts between them. It's a much more complex world. And so that's what I refer to as traditional polytheism in the book.
Okay. I mean, that's, you know, like you said, those are terms where, surprisingly, especially in the realm of religion, they fit and they work quite well, and they haven't really shifted around all too much. So they're pretty helpful.
No. If you go back 2,000 years and look at the debates around early Christianity and Greco-Roman polytheism, you'll find those divisions are right there. And you know, so on, as far back as monotheism goes, as far back as the really expanded form of monotheism. In the early strata of the Bible, it is certainly, it reads as though the God of Israel was simply the God of this one tribe, one God among many, who the Jews worship because that was their God. But there were other gods of other people, and gods were getting into it. And the point was that Jehovah was mightier than the other gods. He was the toughest god on the block, not that he was the one and only. Only later do you have this evolution toward classical monotheism, the infinite, eternal, omni-everything god.
Is that a common polytheistic reading of the Old Testament? I mean, once again, this was going to be the big struggle with this chat, so I will put this out there before we go forward. When it comes to polytheism, there's going to be a lot of, I think there's going to be a lot of I don't knows, and your experience may vary, sort of, you know.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. There is no polytheist dogma. The fact that you have many gods also means you have many opinions. And so many of the polytheists whom I have talked to, who are familiar with the Bible, do in fact interpret the Old Testament very much in terms of the partisans of one deity, the God of Israel, presenting their version of events and their God as the powerful storm god of Mount Sinai and so on. And then gradually, as you go later in the Old Testament, more philosophical ideas seep in and more expansive ideas seep in Alfred North Whitehead used to call metaphysical flattery seeps in, and this tribal deity is inflated into the lord of the entire cosmos, which he doesn't seem to have been back in the days when he was strolling in the Garden of Eden, you know, come the evening, calling out to Adam, oh, where are you, guy?
So the bigger question, I guess, naturally, now I think of it, I was sort of dreading this question, but I don't think it'll be as tough. If we split with monotheism and then polytheism, what is God and what are gods?
What are gods? We can take the word God this is one of the great footballs. Okay, what does this word mean? To a monotheist, the word God means the infinite, eternal, omni, you know, being, and there's only one of him. That's what the word means to them, and they are very, very defensive about, you know, raising barricades around that word so only they can use it. One historic problem, of course, is that that word was used by the Anglo-Saxons for their own the deities of their own polytheist faith before the Christians got to it. So, you know, we kind of have prior rights. But what is a god? There's a lot of dissension about that, a lot of disagreement. Again, you know, it's not as though we all have a manual or something. I mean, there are lots of manuals, but no one of them is conclusive. I would argue that a god is a being that human beings worship. We can make it that simple. A god is a being that human beings worship. And so there can be many gods of many different levels of power and wisdom and benevolence. And some of them are very small gods. You see this routinely in polytheist faiths, where there are very minor deities who are still worthy of worship and will still benefit their worshippers. And then there are greater gods and greater still. But if we go to any definition beyond a god as a being that humans worship, you're starting to bring in agendas. You're starting to bring in theology. You're starting to claim, my god is a god and your god isn't a god, and that all ends in confusion very quickly.
So, I mean, would you, in terms of it, God being something that people need to worship, would you say that there has to be some inherent characteristics for it to be defined a god, like a level, like he's talking about a level of power? It couldn't simply be a human being, possibly.
Well, there have been people who've been worshipped as gods. Mm-hmm. Mostly that happens when they're dead. And there's many religions have an arrangement whereby a dead person can, you know, because people pray to them and miracles happen and prayers are answered and things like that, and they gradually get promoted up the celestial hierarchy. It's very, very akin to what the Roman Catholics have in a sort of rounded off form in terms of their belief in sainthood. But you know, where you draw the line between a god and a saint, where you draw the line between a god and an archangel, that's a matter of complex calculations, and they differ as any word differs. Just as in many languages, there is no separate word for orange, for the color orange. Mm-hmm. In many languages, there is no separate word defining gods from, say, the beings that your traditional Christians refer to, archangels and angels.
So, as I understand, most polytheists, however, and I think this is true for your own Druid tradition, would be that there isn't a monotheistic god, but there is often a primary god. So there is some primary god that might be easier for the monotheistic minds to go, so there is still this perhaps central god, mm-hmm. who is the creator in some sense.
No, there is very often a central god. Whether the god is a creator is quite another matter. And whether there is there is also very often a concept that there is some one power or source from which everything unfolds. But whether that is conceptualized as God or not is another matter. Very often, there is a great god. There is a king of the gods or a queen of the gods. There is a deity who is considered to be the most powerful, the most wise, the most benevolent of the lot. And all other gods and goddesses are in relationship to that one god. That's something that some monotheists can get behind. Then you have outfits, you have traditions like Greek pagan Neoplatonism, where there's the concept of the one, which is not a god, which is the source of being, the ground of being, if you want to use a current theological term. And then there are the gods who are reflections of that on the next level of reality down. And there's a lot, you will routinely get, of course, the entire tradition of Christian Neoplatonism is based on the identifying that primal source, that ground of being, as the God of Israel, as the God, as the Father of Jesus, and so on. Mm-hmm. There are questions that can be reasonably raised by polytheists about that identification, but it's a wide world, and there are a lot of Christian Neoplatonists who see that as relevant.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this is something to emphasize about your book. I mean, for someone who I would even though it has this specific discussion around polytheism, I would recommend it for people who perhaps even were atheists who were becoming agnostics, who were thinking something might be going on, or people who just wanted to delve into spirituality, because you do have two sections regarding arguments for theism, for gods, and arguments against them, and one of them, and it's one of the best books, really, to have all these arguments in one place and spoken about quite articulately, but, very quickly. You can often get bogged down in the Dawkins-esque literature where they have an agenda. Yeah.
The problem is that with the arguments for and against the existence of gods, there's the atheist version of them, which always downplays the arguments for and, frankly, overstresses the arguments against. And then there's the monotheist version, which flips that and puts a great deal of loading on arguments that really don't work, and especially the ontological argument. And the kind of brush aside the very awkward arguments against.
So,
but the one thing I want to point out is that most of this is again fixated on the idea there must be either one God who is very much the God described by Christian tradition, or there can be none, and that causes a lot of polytheists to look at the whole literature and kind of chuckle, because it very rarely has anything to do with our beliefs. But go on, you were about to say.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, we don't have time to cover the majority of the arguments here, but I did think I would ask you about it. Well, maybe two. So, firstly, you've mentioned it, so I'll begin with it. Anselm's ontological argument, because you begin with this one, and you seem to really, this is the one that you clearly were quite excited, I think, to write about, because you really don't like it. And I bring this in because it's often seen as one of the stronger arguments,
and yet it's a logical fallacy. I've referred to it, in fact, more often these days as Last Anselm's Fallacy, because he is confusing an is and an ought. And he is assuming that his chosen definition of a concept must control how the concept acts in the real world. So he's confusing, you know, the world of his mentation with the world of experience. It's as though he was to decide that all hazels were trees and start insisting that they all ought to grow straight up and have, you know, have a big, you know, a single stem and a big bushy, you know, foliage up high because he thinks they're trees. So, you know, just for the benefit of our listeners who are probably hopelessly confused at this point, Anselm's argument is that he defines God as that being whom it is best to be rather than not to be, who is the, you know, the extreme example of it's better for God to be than not to be. Okay. And he then goes on to say, okay, but a God that exists is better than a God that does not exist. Therefore, if we grant this definition, then the God must exist, because otherwise it would be possible to imagine a God who was better than he was. And this is a classic example of why so many people consider philosophy to be a waste of time. And it's very unfortunate, because there's a lot of good philosophy out there, but this is not a good example of it. If you start with a definition, an arbitrary definition, please note.
The greatest
and
possible being.
The greatest possible being, or the best possible being, or the most, you know, there are various ways you can play it. But you start with the definition of greatest possible being, and then you spin that definition to try to demand that the universe correspond to your definition. And, of course, greatest is also a weasel word, because he doesn't just mean greatest as in largest. He's muddling together greatest and morally best and best to be rather than not to be, and so on and so forth. And so it's really a triumph of bad logic. And the reason that I gave so much room for it is partly because, as you've said, a lot of monotheists make a beeline toward that one, because it's the argument for the existence of deities that really does seem to argue for the existence of one deity and only one deity, because the greatest possible being, not beings who are greater. Okay. And so I may be being unfair to poor Anselm, but it really looks as though he's engaging in a fantastic degree of question begging here.
So it's an immediate case of, okay, there may very well be this greatest possible being, or there is being, but to then equate that with the leap between that and the specifics of, say, you know, well, we're talking about Anselm, so the Bible is where the fallacy is really falling apart.
As with so many pieces of Christian logic, and this is one of the problems that's haunted the tradition from the Middle Ages straight through to fairly recently. There's a lot of things that work if you assume that the only alternative to Christian monotheism is atheism. Pascal's Wager is another great example. You're doubtless familiar with it. You know, Pascal is saying, you know, okay, either God exists or he doesn't exist. If he exists and I believe in him, I go to heaven. If he exists and I don't believe him, I go to hell. If he doesn't exist, it doesn't matter either way. So therefore, I should believe in him because my chances are better. Except what happens if there's more than one religion? Okay, here are the Muslims. They have a very different, you know, if you want to go to heaven, you have to follow their God and not the Christian God. Okay, and here are the Buddhists, and here are the Hindus, and here are the Druids, for heaven's sake. Who's right? And so the whole shebang falls apart once you assume the reality, once you accept the reality of religious plurality. And that's a pervasive problem with certain kinds of Christian philosophy.
Which monotheistic argument do you find personally the strongest? Speaking as a polytheist.
Well, if I found any of them strong, I probably wouldn't be a polytheist. Yeah. I find the argument from design I find suggestive. It does not, I think, argue well for monotheism. Mm. It argues well for the existence of deities. It doesn't prove anything. but it does. It's a little awkward to, you know, it's a little easier to explain the complexity of the world and the way that the sort of anthropic condition is easier to explain with that than with the well, it just happened by chance. But
do you find it very human centric though?
Oh yes. Thing is, we can't not be human centric. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, we are all working with human minds. We have human perspectives. We can only see the world through human eyes. So what we're perceiving will necessarily be anthropocentric. That's just who we are. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, the arguments for monotheism are almost all based on they have a valid basis on the one hand, which is the tradition and experience. Lots of people have perceived Jesus. Lots of people have mm-hmm. experienced Jesus, have experienced the Christian deity. Okay, mm-hmm. I grant that absolutely and flatly. That's a god, mm-hmm. and you know, by all reason, it's reasonable to assume that if you know, on the basis of all this experience and so on, that if you worship that god, you will receive the benefits that are promised to you. Okay, mm-hmm. that's. The challenge then becomes, okay, what about the fact that other people also perceive their deities? Other people mm-hmm. also have miracles, and, you know, have prayers answered, they receive miraculous healings. It's not as though the only God who shows up, the only God who answers prayers, the only God who does anything is this one God over here. In fact, it's very common. Every religion has such things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the implication that I draw from this is that Christianity is a wholly valid religion, and if you yourself are a Christian, you're perfectly within your rights to skedaddle down to Mass every Sunday or whichever variety of Christianity you practice. Okay, that is not subject to question. It's when you start saying that you've got the only God and everyone else is wrong that your logic is getting faulty, and when it turns into the hostage logic that's sometimes used by churches, you know, there's only one God, we've got him, and if you ever want to see him again, you'd better pay your tithes. That is garbage.
So what might you say, I mean, because I'm sure there's polytheists who would use various monotheistic gods within their their group of gods that they worship, right? What would you say perhaps to those that, I mean, we're using Christianity here because I think it's the most common mm-hmm. monotheistic language of the West, which is where we're both from, so what mm-hmm. we're speaking about.
Yes.
So it's sort
we
of
the, might as well.
Well, it's the best counter because most people are familiar with it. So what might you say to those who would say that those polytheists who include, say, Jesus within their grouping of gods aren't taking that religion within its correct context by doing so?
I would say that they have every right to their own opinion. Since the gods themselves are not showing up and saying, and you know, showing up in a blaze of glory on High Street right now and saying, this is how I want to be worshipped, and if you don't do this, you're going to be flung into a pit of fiery scorpions forever. All we have are human testimonies. Mm. All we have are human testimonies which are shaped, powerfully shaped, in I think every case, by human needs, human desires, human foibles, occasional bursts of human nastiness. Mm. That's what we have to go on. The gods themselves seem to be satisfied with that. They don't know. Again, they're presumably, if they wanted to, they could show up on High Street in a blaze of glory and hand out the details, but apparently they don't. And since we live in a kind of world where the gods are less apparent than that, when they don't, you know, they're not, you know, blazing in glory, except, you know, to the extent that you happen to be a sun worshiper, let's say, you know, we all have our own opinions. We all try to find an approach to divinity, an approach to the relationship between humanity and divinity that works for us. Mm. And people are going to disagree. Mm. That's, you know, that's the nature of humanity. Mm. Are some right and some wrong? It's certainly possible. But the evidence does not suggest that one group of people is morally superior to another. Mm. I mean, that, for example, Christians show no particular sign of being moral superior to Muslims or to Hindus or to Druids, for that matter. Equally, the, you know, again, there's the evidence for miracles and from answered prayers and things like that. Christians have plenty of them, but so do other religions. So very clearly, whatever is going on there appears to be plenty of room for religious diversity, and the gods don't seem to be interested in frying people who, say, put a statue of Jesus on their altar next to statues of half a dozen others. People have been doing that for 2,000 years now. Mm-hmm. And going unfried with lightning bolts. Jehovah isn't frying them. Zeus isn't frying them. So apparently all the lightning bolt wielders are going, okay, no, that's cool. And I know it's very unpopular to take that and that kind of divine forbearance as evidence, but I think it should at least be kept in mind that if they wanted to intervene, they could. Mm-hmm. And since they don't seem to be particularly upset about the matter, it's not the only data point to consider, but maybe it's worth keeping in mind. Mm.
So, just out of interest, I mean, do you abide by that? Going back to Christianity, I mean, do you think it's you have that Nietzschean split between, because I know you have a lot to do with the Gnostic Church. Do you abide by that sort of Nietzschean split where, we were talking about how human agendas often come in and take a religion another way, the Nietzschean split mm-hmm. between sort of Jesus and then Paul, and that in Paul we see more of the, for Nietzsche this is, we see more of that turning it into something mm-hmm. which is very much more human.
I think that that's a very popular thing, and Nietzsche is a large reason why it's popular. I don't know that I would agree with that. Mm-hmm. I think partly Nietzsche was trying to construct a Jesus that he wanted, and Jesus these days we know so little about him, and the testimonies are so many and varied, especially now that we have the alternative gospels, that mm-hmm. it's pretty much a matter of you can have whatever Jesus you want. Mm-hmm. And Nietzsche certainly availed himself of that. I wasn't there at the time. I don't have independent any kind of independent access to information about what the historical person Jesus of Nazareth was and taught and did, and what the historical person Saul of Tarsus was and sought and did. We have these testimonies. We have these profoundly mythic and frankly profoundly moving testimonies in the forms of both the canonical and the extra-canonical gospels, the canonical and extra-canonical epistles, and so on. As a Gnostic of sorts, I tend to put, as Gnostics do, a focus on gnosis, on personal experience, rather than believing in Scripture. Mm-hmm. And so the whole matter is less important, because it's not a matter of, this book, you have to, cling to this book and every word is your salvation. It's a matter of, at most, this book is a guide. This book mm-hmm. is a help. It is a springboard that you can use en route to your own personal interaction with the divine in whatever form that takes.
Mm-hmm. One more, almost like somewhat of a fantasy question, if that's okay.
Sure.
On this route somewhat. Because this is often asked to atheists in these famous Christian versus atheist debates. Mm-hmm. So I thought it would be interesting to ask a polytheist, because it's not mm-hmm. something you often hear. Let's say when you pass away, instead of mm-hmm. You can probably see where this is going, instead of being reincarnated, as I believe you believe mm-hmm. currently, mm-hmm. you open your eyes, and before you is the gates of heaven, and there is Saint Peter. What would you say to him?
My immediate thought is, wow, okay, I was wrong.
Yeah, okay.
And I would go up and say, okay, I was mistaken. What are the what are the rules? What can I hope for? Have I flushed my chance down the crapper or what? And find out the situation. But that's the Gnostic attitude. It's not a matter of knowing. It's a matter of accepting that being human, we are fallible. Mm-hmm. Being human, all we can do is take our best guess and go with that. And, if there's Saint Peter, presumably he's open to having a conversation, and mm-hmm. and we'll see where it goes from there. I certainly don't claim to be morally perfect. If some version of the standard monotheist heaven, purgatory, hell thing comes through, is in fact what's waiting on the other side, I will doubtless at best have a good long time to spend in purgatory. And I accept that. And, I you know, like many people, I strive to be a better person, but I don't claim to have succeeded in achieving the kind of perfection. And when Jesus said, you know, be ye perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect, I'm saying, okay, that's a great idea. I hope that's not the minimum passing grade.
But this we've been talking about proof, we've been talking about evidence as well, and this brings us, you know, mm-hmm. you were talking about gnosis, about, well, what's my experience? What, you know, mm-hmm. we are these individually souled beings throughout mm-hmm. the universe. So what's this notion of experience? And you point out the great irony. You know, I think it's after the chapters of proofs and disproofs that there is just this complete move away from, well, hang on, what about personal experience as evidence in this mm-hmm. in a mm-hmm. in the so-called secular materialist society that would, you know, Richard Dawkins screaming with his lungs, show me evidence,
and yet there's all kinds of evidence that he won't look at.
yeah,
exactly. The thing is, Dawkins and atheists generally, they are, from my perspective, they're not atheists, they're a-Christians.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I've had conversations with atheists where they were literally arguing with me, insisting that the Christian God is the only possible God anyone can believe in. And I'm saying, what? And they're as devout as any Christian. The only difference between them and the fundamentalist down the street is the minor point that they don't believe, they have the same concept of God, they just don't believe he exists.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird. You'd think that atheists would be a little more broad-minded, but they aren't. And I think many of them are just reacting against Christianity. They're reacting against perhaps the church that they grew up in.
Yeah.
I've known a certain number of atheists who, for example, were gay, and who got, you know, got desperately tired of being treated as though they were subhuman scum
mm-hmm.
by Christian churches that insisted on vilifying that particular, you know, form of human sexual attraction. And so, yeah, they went hardcore atheists and started bashing back. I'm fairly sure that's what was going on with Nietzsche, by the way. no, seriously.
Well,
He was gay. Mm. It's really funny. I mean, the mental illness that killed him shows various, you know, it has a lot of similarities with tertiary syphilis. And yet the biographers are saying, yet he was never known to spend time with women. Mm. He had a lot of intimate friendships with men, however. And you know, and so you can see Nietzsche. Here's this young man raised, you know, he was a minister's son, raised in the finest traditions of German Protestantism, German Lutheran faith, mm. and then he goes away to college, and he falls in love with another young man. Not, you know, this panting, craving lust, but the kind of love that you only get in idealistic 19th century Europeans, where it's just the highest and holiest thing. And his religion tells him that that makes him a depraved sinner that deserves to get the boot in the face forever. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he became an atheist. A lot of people did. The unamazing Randy, James Randi, is another example of that same pattern. And so you get a lot of people there reacting, but more generally, whether it is specifically a sexual thing, whether it's some other aspect, there's a lot of reasons why people will turn against Christianity or turn against specifically whatever church they were raised in, whatever form of Christianity they believe in. And very often they're so busy being against Christianity that that's all they are.
Mm-hmm.
Their atheism is simply Christianity stood on its head.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
With a big zero in the place of you know, God, of God Almighty, so the conversations get very strange when a polytheist sits down with an atheist and says, "Yeah, but that's not the God I'm talking about."
There's a huge irony in that as well. That so one thing is, you know, this sort of atheist turn against, and I'm in complete agreement. I mean, we see this with the so-called four horsemen, that really they were mostly against Christianity, as you've been saying.
Oh yeah,
and
except they like to bash Islam also. That, and
yeah,
that was quite
sort of
fashionable.
That was fashionable, and it was a political fashion of the day.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
to to signal your sort of radicality from a position of utmost safety as well for them.
Of course.
But it draws out something that you emphasize massively in the latter part of the book, which is a conflation with worship, religion, spirituality in a monotheistic sense, solely with morality. God is just moralism. And I think we see this in the atheists because they turn against it. But actually, as you've said, it's you're basically believing the same thing, but you just don't believe in the God is. Nothing really changes because even Richard Dawkins has said that he's culturally Christian, right? You know, people say like, oh, we're moving away from a Christian nation. And as far as I can see, it's like, well, we still have marriage, which is, you know, one man, one woman. There isn't, on that basic moral level, in a mass, in the sense of the masses, nothing has really changed that much. And I think it's because of that Alan Watts talks about it, writes about it quite well. I'm not huge on Alan Watts, but he writes about it quite well in his book Zen, where he says, look, as soon as you conflate God with just morality, it means that, you know, when you have some grievance against them or some paradox where you go, well, I'm like this, you know, so, but this doesn't fit into the religion. It's not like you've pushed against something minor or you have a problem with something minor. Your slight is literally against God, you know. And one thing you emphasize is, well, that's not what all of worship and all of religion is. It isn't simply moralism.
There has been this pervasive tendency, and it's something that happens in many traditions. It's something you can see actually in Greek polytheism at a certain point, where it starts being moralized. It starts being turned into a set of moral precepts, ultimately into a system of crowd control equipment. If you read a lot of Victorian writing where people are talking about, people of the upper classes are talking about the virtue of Christianity being that it keeps the lower orders in line. Mm-hmm. And that's a degeneration. But the fixation on morality is a degeneration. I mean, morality is important. Ethics are important. But there's also experiential contact with deities. There's also gnosis. There's also the life of prayer and the development of the spirit in relationship to the divine. And that has morality is associated with that. There are certain moral issues that you need to get under control before you can do that effectively. But it's not all about keeping your legs tightly crossed. You know, there's more to religion than following a set of rules. And the fact that so many religions, especially in the Western world, have turned into purely moralizing things where it's all about, here are the rules you must follow, and if you don't, God will beat you up. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, even in terms of historic Christianity, that is a degradation of the tradition. And it explains, I think, a lot of why so many people have you know, abandoned Christianity, because they're sick and tired of being preached at. They're sick and tired of being told, you have to do this, especially by people for whom do what I say, not what I do, is very often a suitable rule.
Mm-hmm. So how do we know God, then? How do we get this experience? And what is this experience?
Okay. That's like saying, what is the experience of interacting with another human being? Gods are diverse. They're different. And they're also being persons. You know, they're not the same. They're not like vending machines. You can't get something reliable out of them anytime you want to. But the method is the same as again, you talk to them. That's why prayer is such a big deal in all the world's religions. You go, you know, go all the way to the other end of Eurasia, go to Japan, and you're talking, you know, you talk to a Shinto priest, and he will tell you, here are these traditional prayers, and here are also just your own personal prayers. It's not that different, even though the theology is as far from, say, Roman Catholicism as it's possible to be. You still have the regular services. You still have the traditional prayers in old-fashioned formal language. You still have the personal prayer of the heart. You still have the devotions, the little offerings made at the, you know, that you make like lighting a candle in the Chapel of the Virgin or something. The Japanese have an exact equivalent. The technology, if you will, and that's kind of a bad word, but it gets the point across. The techniques of interacting with gods do not vary much from tradition to tradition. There are certain basic categories. You can always have a feast. That's what animal sacrifice was back in Rome, Greek and Roman times. It's what animal sacrifice was in the Jewish communities before the fall of the temple. Mm-hmm. That's what animal sacrifice is in Vodun and Santeria these days. It's a feast. It's a big dinner party to which the gods are invited as guests. Mm-hmm. You can pray. You can talk to them. Mm-hmm. And then you can listen for the answer, which is the thing that a lot of people forget to do these days. And you can just pay attention and listen and abide with and wait for an answer to come. And it's not, you know, as the Bible points out, it's a still small voice. It's not thunder and lightning and, you know, radiant figures while you're standing on High Street. There are a range of other practices. Whatever religion you choose, you will find them. Well, except for some of the very modern, watered-down religions that have basically abandoned all their technique, and it's just a matter of sitting in a dreary auditorium listening to somebody tell you how to behave. But in traditional religions, you'll find, you know, they've got rosaries, for example. They've got specific prayers. They've got specific meditations. They've got specific practices. There are ceremonies that will help you get into a state of harmony with the divine, so it will be easy for you to communicate with them. And if you practice these things, you know, if you practice these consistently and also follow the various moral rules of morality and rules of personal comportment, if you will, that go along with that, you get results.
Mm-hmm. So, two questions in one. For someone who is worshipping a singular god or perhaps a group of gods, where do all the other gods that are acknowledged by other people go, and why don't they, you know, appear?
Well, the thing, you know, when you go, if you're married and you come home from work, you're not going to find everyone else's wife sitting at home waiting for you, or everyone else's husband. Relationships are what they are. You know, and the fact that the gods are less constrained by, many gods at least, are less constrained by space and time than we are, make it very easy for them to interact with the people who are interacting with them and to not interact with others. Now, it does sometimes happen that people who are working with one deity will have an unexpected encounter with another. In fact, it happens all the time. The Bible is a bit of evidence for that. Think of Saul of Tarsus suddenly getting a vision of Jesus. He was not going around looking for that vision to happen, and yet thought there it was. And the thing is, that kind of thing happens all the time. But because humans are not the only ones who can initiate such a relationship. You know, the gods are not passive to us. The gods are not sitting there waiting and drumming their fingers on a celestial desk somewhere waiting for us to call. They're active. They're superlatively active in the world. And sometimes they will make themselves known to somebody. Other times, you know, they have other things to do, and they don't necessarily hassle us unless we put ourselves into a situation where we invite their contact, or we put ourselves in a situation where their contact is appropriate, where they decide to interact. But one of the things that polytheists quite routinely do is simply acknowledge that, you know, in a world full of gods, to borrow the title of my book back, there are always going to be many, many gods with whom you personally will not interact. Just as in a city full of people, there will be plenty of people you never meet. And it's purely a matter of what relationships do you cultivate, what encounters do you have, what interactions do you seek out and engage in. It determines which gods you spend time with.
Mm-hmm. So I guess encompassing everything we've spoken about, do you feel that there are any universals across all of worship? Because reading about more different gods, reading different books, I think, well, just speaking for myself, I begin to see that perhaps we wouldn't call it gnosis, but there is, for some people would call it gnosis, but there is a, and they'd certainly not call it, well, no, we could call it progress, but not in the type that you often write about, but there is a movement towards development, towards people having individual souls, and if you want to be an animist, plants, animals having reasons or you can even say jobs to do within the time and place they've been allotted, and that's all moving towards some sort of evolution, some sort of development. Do you think such a universal does go across all of worship or not?
I have never encountered anything that is common to all religions. I know that there are certainly many religions that do believe that there's this sort of movement across time. There are other religions that see it as a cycle. And, you know, there's a movement in a direction, then a movement back in the other direction, or what have you. That things, and there are still others where you think of a lot of tribal religions where the idea, you have like the Australian Aboriginal idea of the dream time. Everything that mattered actually took place in ancient times. And that dream time still exists now as a kind of hovering presence, but nothing actually now, nothing that anyone can do now can do anything but reenact what was done in the first time, in the dream time. And so they very clearly don't have that view. And now I would suggest that, in fact, human beings are not that bright. We're trying to comprehend a universe trillions of light years across, and the instrument we're using is a lump of greasy jello 6 inches long. Okay. We have done remarkably well with the very limited equipment, very limited mental equipment at our, at our disposal. With a nervous system that was apparently evolved for the not especially demanding task of dodging leopards and finding gazelles and tasty roots on the East African plains. We've done amazing things, and I suspect the gods are watching us going, you know, that, for someone at that level, that was really quite charming, the way we do when a six-year-old does something really bright. We're not that smart. We are certainly not, you know, the summit of existence, the measure of all things, all of this anthropocentric garbage that has been so obsessively dinned into our ears in Western industrial societies. We are simply one kind of being, one mode of embodiment, if you believe in reincarnation, one stage of the process of spiritual evolution through which a certain souls inevitably pass. And there are many, many beings in the cosmos who are a lot smarter and a lot more powerful and a lot more able to perceive things than we are. And so the important thing is not to try to get bent out of shape over, well, you know, so does history move in a direction, or is it in a circle, or is it the dream time that's just reenacting, or blah, blah, blah. Okay. Probably the reality is so much grander and so much more complex and so much more multidimensional than we can begin to grasp that you can take any of these three or any other thing and say, okay, I'm going to accept that as a working hypothesis within the system because it makes sense of the experiences, and let's not get bent out of shape about it. Let's not certainly go beat up on other people who believe the other way because they're wrong and we're right, you know, that kind of nonsense.
So one other thing, I mean, jumping a bit further back now, but just this idea of universals and drawing in the morality, it does seem to me, though, I think you may disagree because I'll say what I'm going to say. It does seem to me that there is a certain morality which is somewhat globally accepted. You know, it's been accepted that it's, you know, we don't kill other people, we don't steal. Borders are generally respected in local communities. And so how do you think it is amidst all the different modes of worship? You know, do you think that there is we could call, like, in a Jungian sense, like, there is a morality of the collective unconscious, or do you think something else is going on there that has allowed this to spread amidst all these different modes of worship?
I think partly we're dealing with a lot of morality is simply the rules that human beings have evolved to enable us to live in relative amity with each other and not kill each other. And since we are, in our own way, very limited beings with very predictable sets of desires and cravings and bad habits, the set of rules that works is going to be broadly similar in a lot of places. So to that extent, you do have a kind of species-wide morality. And that, you know, any human being, any being with this particular set of desires, this particular set of failings, and so on, this set of rules is going to work tolerably well. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of variation within that. I mean, when can you kill? When can you kill another human being? Almost every society has some context in which you can do that. Whether that's warfare, whether that's feud, you know, there are limits to it, but it's an option. What are the limits? It depends incredibly on where you are. Marriage. That's one that we get, especially nowadays, with that whole thing being so, you know, so controverted these days with same-sex couples getting married and so on. Marriage customs around the world are extremely varied. It is simply not the case that the Christian model is the universal that many people consider it. There are many places, for example, that marriage actually doesn't determine who sleeps with whom. Nor does it determine whose children you raise. In a lot of Native American, both North and South American cultures, children are raised by the children of one couple are raised by the maternal uncle of the couple, or the maternal brother. There are all of these different ways of doing things. And they all seem to work fairly well within their own culture. But you're right that there are common things that, you know, stealing has, you know, there will always be places where stealing is legal. We have government taxation, for example, in our societies. There will always be places where killing is legal. But there are limits on these things. And there are limits for very good reasons, because, again, you're trying to come up with a set of rules that will allow people to live together in relative peace, and we're not as diverse as we like to pretend.
So, a couple more questions on the more religious, sure. The more religious side of things. I mean, pushing aside the atheists who've just made it their identity to, you know, debate and blah, 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 this whole cult of I am correct, nothing to do with the truth, I am just correct within a very... Speaking more of atheists who are people who perhaps, you know, tried their hand or just were like, no, this isn't a thing, where it's, the world is completely material. Is this a case of, you know, putting your fingers in your ears, closing your eyes and ignoring a certain element of what it is to be a human, or is it something else?
Well, the thing is, there are people who are colorblind. There are people who have absolutely no ear for music. There are people, I'm one of them, for example, who dance. I'm the equivalent of colorblind for dance. Dance doesn't do anything for me, either doing it or watching it. It's just, then there are people who are godblind. There are people for whom religion just doesn't mean anything. Within my own religious tradition, the idea is, you know, as souls reach the human level, from having completed a number of animal incarnations, their first job is to get used to the human level, and they're going to be materialistic because that's their job. That's what they're doing in that life. Later on, as they get established at the human level, they get comfortable with it. They then start to yearn for the next level up, and that's when you start getting serious religious interest. But that's, you know, that's the tradition within the specific teaching I follow. The fact remains that religious concerns are very important to some people, mildly important to most people, and not important at all to a certain number of people. And that simply seems to be the way human beings are. Again, you know, some of us are tone deaf.
Do you have a spiritual reason as to the increase in secularity and atheism?
Okay, I don't see that as so much spiritual as historical. It is very, very common in the history of societies complex societies, civilizations, we might as well call them, okay? Civilizations will reach a certain point of complexity and a certain point of intellectual development where they will launch into an age of reason. And there have been lots of ages of reason. We're coming out of ours right now. And the intellectual pride cuts in, and the belief in naturalistic explanations, and a certain amount of raw egotism. You know, we are the most important beings in the world. Forget about these gods. And now the age of reason is never anything but the traditional religion society with all the serial numbers filed off. That's why, you know, our physicists, our cosmologists begin the universe with the Big Bang, which is nothing more than "and let there be light," with a little bit of secular spray paint poured over, you know, squirted over it, and so on. There's secular thought is always just religious thought reframed in a less convincing framework, but you get that. And as it becomes widespread, as it becomes popular, as it just gets dinned into people's heads over and over again, you tend to get that movement toward secularism, and even within religious groups, the religions go the way so many of our religions have in the Western world and become just moralizing or something like that. And then typically the pendulum comes swinging the other way, usually as the society begins to decline rapidly, and you have what Oswald Spengler called the second religiosity, and where people flee back into religion as much as a bulwark against chaos, both social chaos and internal mental chaos, because ages of reason are rootless. Ages of reason are confused. They never actually have an explanation for anything, and you know, and including an explanation for why you should live and not die. And so people end up fleeing back into religion because it offers a stable set of explanations and a reason to keep living and a reason to, and a framework to keep chaos both without and within at bay. And so we're getting that right now, of course, in the modern world. We're starting to see a lot of people who were raised in who were raised in atheism, or who were raised in the kind of, well, it doesn't really matter sort of attitude that's so widespread now, who are starting to seek out religious communities. We'll see much more of that in the years ahead. And so that's just that. That's simply a part of the historical cycle. It's got its wrinkles. It's got its complexities, but it's a familiar thing to anyone who watches the cycles of history.
Do you see that second religiosity as really being primarily from a position of faith as opposed to experience, though? Because you have a lot to say in your book about this notion of just having just faith is different.
Yeah, no. It typically starts with people fleeing to a belief, fleeing to ultimately an ideology, but it tends to lead then into a refocusing on experience, which is why you tend to have during the second religiosity, you tend to have a major upsurge in mysticism, and people who are piling into mystical practices because they want to make that refuge against chaos as solid as it can be. And direct experience of deity is one of the ways you do that. That's why you have the origins of the Christian monastic traditions right out of the most chaotic period of the fall of the Roman world. And you have people going off, into monasteries and devoting themselves to frightful austerities and, prayers where they don't even take time off for sleep, and having visions of gods and the saints and so on, and actually achieving that state of experience. I don't think we're quite there yet in terms of the mainstream religions, but it's picking up. It's moving in that direction, certainly. And with the emergence of the second religiosity in the modern industrial world, it is worth noting that people are especially seem to be moving back toward the more experiential, more sacramental, more ceremonial churches. They're not going for the, sit in a drafty auditorium and listen to somebody talk to you about morality kind of church.
Do you see a future in which polytheism has a sharp increase?
Oh yeah, we're right now kind of on the downslope from the Wiccan bubble. it happens regularly. You have these surges of pop culture spirituality. Spiritualism had one, Theosophy had one, Wicca had one.
That was a good one.
Yeah, exactly. They go way up, up with a rocket, down with a stick. And so, there's a lot of confusion and so on, but certainly there has been a lot of interest in, well, for example, the book that we're discussing. I had no trouble placing it with a rising significant publisher in the in the alternative spirituality field, where it had been originally published with a really little bitty press. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely an interest in this kind of thing. There's an interest in the United States, for example. One of the really successful neo-pagan religions is heathenry, the worship of the Norse or Germanic deities. That has become a solid tradition, something where, you know, people have, there are buildings, there are congregations. It's a rising thing. There are also the African diaspora religions, Vodun, Santeria, and so, Candomblé, and so on. Those are spreading very quickly in the United States, and those are also very polytheistic. They've got a lively tradition, they've got powerful rituals, and they appeal to people. So I think, you know, what exact kind of polytheism will evolve, you know, over the centuries to come, I don't claim to know. But polytheism seems to be the default setting for many people, many cultures, and it's what people slide into. You can watch the sort of the emergence of the cult of the saints and many kinds of Christianity as a kind of quasi-polytheistic move toward that same sort of experience of divine multiplicity.
Are you planning on writing more books or more perhaps blog posts specifically on polytheism?
Oh, it's quite possible. I don't usually make a lot of plans for, you know, far ahead of where I've gotten to. I have a couple of books to write now that are not on that subject, but once I get, and I do have a couple of things in mind for future, but as I get some things cleared out of the way, it will be very much a matter of, okay, what am I going to write now? What fires me up? What has me going, oh yeah, that would be fun to research and write, or what have you. And so it's quite possible that I'll be doing something on that, on those terms, but we'll see.
Well, I know we chatted fairly recently, so I mean, I could ask you what you're working on, but I think it might be possibly about the same. Because you've usually got some.
Projects. It's about the same. I'm still working on the book on polarity magic. I'm working on the. My publisher is quite eager to get that one, so that's at the top of the stack right now. Mm-hmm. I've got a couple of novels to work on and so on. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
And how about the, you loosely mentioned something about Dionne Fortune. Is that going to be a book on specifically her, or is that under wraps at the moment?
Okay, the question is, which part of Dionne Fortune are we talking about? Ah. My set of commentaries on the Cosmic Doctrine, that's in print. Mm-hmm. That's available now, and it's going to be a minority taste, because of course the Cosdoc is extremely intricate and complex, and it requires an interest in serious occult philosophy. But you know, some people apparently have that interest. There are some other Dionne Fortune projects that I have in mind. Okay. Certainly, there's a lot of Dionne Fortune going into the book on polarity magic that I was talking about just now.
All right. Well, I'll put the links for A World Full of Gods in the description below. But
thank you,
Michael Greer. Once again, it's been a great discussion. Thanks very much.
Thank you much. I always enjoy being on.